I next met with Dr. Virginia Caclamani, and to begin, I asked her about emerging data on the use of novel selective estrogen receptor degraders, SERDs, in the management of ER-positive breast cancer.
If you look at the trials in the metastatic setting, fulvestrant really seems to be the superior endocrine therapy. It's beaten anastrozole in a head-to-head trial. The only limitation is that it's an IM injection. So when you look at the adjuvant setting, it's kind of hard to be thinking of it as moving it to the adjuvant setting. Also, the other limitation is the dose. We can't give as high a dose as we want to because of the IM injection. So that's why companies started developing oral SERDs, so that they can bypass that limitation. So several companies are out there. They've developed SERDs. They are in phase 1/2 trials. I think the furthest along is elacestrant. And we did the phase 1 trial, and I can tell you my one patient who is still on therapy, I put several patients on the trial, but one of them, I just saw her, and she's on her 34th cycle of elacestrant. And so this is a drug that works well. It's pretty well tolerated, a little bit of GI toxicity, especially with an older preparation. But now with the newer preparations, pretty easy to tolerate. Some of the other ones have had some GI side effects as well. I think where the benefit is going to be is probably in the ESR1 mutated patients. And so the trials are now focusing on looking at CDK4/6 inhibitor post-therapy with or without ESR1 mutations. And in patients that have been on fulvestrant, it still seems to be an active drug. So several of the patients on the phase 1 trial had been on previous fulvestrant and enjoyed a pretty good response to RAD1901. So now the phase 3 trial has already started. There have been some patients that have been enrolled. We'll see how it goes, but it's a registrational trial. So if it's positive, the drug will be approved.
How often do you see ESR1 mutations at initial diagnosis of localized disease, first diagnosis of Mets, and later on? And how much of a correlation is there with, you know, benefit? Do you see responses with AIs or tamoxifen?
So in the primary setting, they're very rare. Usually they develop over time, mostly with AI use. And so when you look at the metastatic setting, they're a little bit more common. And that's where the studies have shown that fulvestrant works better than anastrozole, which kind of makes sense since a lot of these patients have already been exposed to anastrozole and have developed those mutations on anastrozole. So now when you look at CDK4/6 inhibitors, the studies have shown that it's pretty equivalent, the benefit, whether the patient has or doesn't have an ESR1 mutation. But really where the issue is going to be on what endocrine backbone to give to patients if they have an ESR1 mutation.
And in terms of this particular agent, I know it's, you know, actually a trial in progress, but I guess the obvious question is, have you seen responses in people who progressed on fulvestrant?
We have. So there was some data that was presented at San Antonio and ASCO, and the full data set will be presented at San Antonio this year. And as you'll see in that data set as well, there's several patients that have been on fulvestrant, several patients that have been on CDK4/6 inhibitors, progressed on both agents, and then went on to RAD1901 and had a good response.
So another ASCO paper poster you had, and I see we're working with Jenny Chang. She really has done some amazing work, and this seems like it's kind of lined up with that. Open-label phase 2 trial of neoadjuvant TAC-228 plus tamoxifen. So first, neoadjuvant always gets my attention, and Jenny had done a lot of stuff with HER2-positive. But anyhow, what's TAC-228, and what's up with this trial?
So that's a dual mTOR inhibitor, and we participated in the trial. You know, there was some concern previously. There was an oral presentation at SABCS, I want to say 2 years ago, looking at a dual mTOR inhibitor, and actually the drug was not effective at all. And that was our concern initially with this trial, but this is a little bit of a different mTOR inhibitor. The results seem, you know, pretty promising. It seems like this might be an agent that we may be using. Now, the benefit, as you know, in the new adjuvant setting is that you can get results quicker. So as long as you have a drug that is relatively well tolerated and we know the toxicity profile, it's easier to try to do a new adjuvant trial with it than to try to do a metastatic trial, especially in these, you know, 1 or 2 or 3 institution trials. So this might be an agent that we'll hear a little bit more about, probably in the metastatic setting. The good news is that now we have, what, three different targeted agents taking away the endocrine therapy. And so with this, we might have four or five, especially with when you add AKT inhibitors to the mix.
You know, actually, what really caught my attention was the neoadjuvant aspect of it. Because, you know, I mean, I don't know, kind of looking back, it always seemed like such a great idea. You know, in endocrine therapy, you know, I guess you can look at the Ki-67 or, you know, I guess that's been done. But I haven't heard too much about using it to even, you know, have the I-SPY out there. I mean, they've done some things. But do you see a resurgence in neoadjuvant therapy, you know, in the ER-positive, HER2-negative situation, both research as well as practice?
I think in research more than practice. Now, maybe with CDK4/6 inhibitors, since they're such active agents, we may see a little bit of a change. My issue with giving endocrine therapy in the neoadjuvant setting is that then you may not know whether you should be giving chemotherapy in the adjuvant setting or not. You know, these tumors are slow growing and they're slowly responding to treatment as well. So you have to treat them for at least 6 months of endocrine therapy, which is a little hard to take. Some of the patients we've had on endocrine therapy for 9 months and they continue to have, you know, slow responses. So it's hard to think in practice of giving these patients neoadjuvant endocrine therapy unless there's limitations. For example, you know, they're older patients, you don't want to take them to surgery. Other patients that have other comorbidities. You know, we have several patients that are on the list for liver transplant and all of a sudden they get diagnosed with breast cancer, but the liver is not in good shape. And so in these patients, it may make sense to give them neoadjuvant endocrine therapy. But in most cases, I think standard of care, we're still going to be looking at adjuvant therapy. But for clinical trials, this is how we learn. This is how we look at these agents and see whether the Ki-67 responds, whether there's other biomarkers of response that can help guide us in the adjuvant and metastatic setting.
Any new strategies in terms of endocrine therapy out there, as long as we're talking about new agents and strategies, maybe looking at neoadjuvant setting that you're excited about?
So the window trials are also pretty interesting where you're giving a very short course, maybe 3 to 4 weeks of treatment, and then you're really assessing whatever your biomarker is, whether it's Ki-67. I think that, again, is going to help us design trials. It's definitely not going to help us find a new standard of care, but it'll help us design trials in the metastatic setting or maybe in the adjuvant setting. I think when you look at agents, the one class of agents that seems to be the furthest along are the AKT inhibitors, together with the oral SERDs, which, again, is another endocrine approach. And then obviously how you combine these agents. Does it make sense to combine a CDK4/6 inhibitor with an mTOR inhibitor? Are you really going to achieve something by that or just sequencing those agents?
What happens when you give endocrine therapy alone as opposed to endocrine therapy plus CDK neoadjuvantly to Ki-67?
You're going to have a little bit of a more drop by giving the CDK4/6 inhibitor with endocrine therapy instead of endocrine therapy by itself. The response is going to be faster as well. But whether you're going to have any long-term benefits, that remains to be seen. We have two large adjuvant trials with CDK4/6 inhibitors that are going to answer this question in our higher risk patients. And then we're going to have a third one, I think, a smaller trial that's going to also be looking at a third CDK4/6 inhibitor. But obviously, these trials are going to report in several years from now, given how slowly this cancer progresses.
Well, sometimes we get surprises, but whenever it does happen, certainly wouldn't be a shock to see them be positive. But then when you think about it, it's going to change the whole platform of adjuvant therapy. You know, things that weren't that big a deal, now maybe you're going to look bigger if you're going to have to do it for a long time.
And that's the thing. You're adding more agents, you're adding more toxicity, but then you're also trying to figure out what are you going to do in the metastatic setting. If you have somebody that right. is on a CDK4/6 inhibitor for a year in the adjuvant setting and then recurs 3 or 4 years later, do you rechallenge them with these agents or not? Those are going to be unanswered questions.
When I brought up the issue of neoadjuvant endocrine therapy clinically, you gave a kind of an approach that characterizes, I'd say, about two-thirds of breast cancer investigators, because there's another third that use genomic assays and, you know, will use endocrine therapy. And, you know, one of the situations that I hear about, we actually had a case that a general medical oncologist presented at one of our meetings, and I don't know how often it happens, is the patient with ER-positive, HER2-negative disease who really needs tumor shrinkage to have breast conservation. And in that situation, I don't know, what do you do? I mean, would you give chemotherapy? Would you look at recurrence score and then decide? What would you do?
I think in that setting, looking at the recurrence score makes sense. Again, there's not large trials, but it's pretty obvious when you look at several neoadjuvant trials with the recurrence score that if you have a low recurrence score, you're not going to get at least PCR with chemotherapy, because that's how we've measured chemotherapy benefit. You may get some benefit. But again, if I have a patient, as long as she's not too young, and she has a recurrence score of 10, me trying to give her chemotherapy in the neoadjuvant setting is probably not going to achieve my goal. But if I feel I have enough time and giving her endocrine therapy in that setting, I think makes sense. Again, I'm going to have to treat her for at least 6 months, but that tumor is slowly going to respond, hopefully making her into a surgical candidate. The other approach I've used recently, especially if you kind of think that this patient is locally advanced and, you know, maybe not metastatic, but definitely micrometastatic, is whether you can add a CDK4/6 inhibitor to that mix, and then you're going to get a better response based on our metastatic data. So that might help, again, making her into a surgical candidate.
That's interesting. How do you approach the use of, you know, outside of trial setting, CDK inhibitors in locally advanced breast cancer?
Yeah, so the one patient that I'm doing this on is a locally recurrent breast cancer. So I guess I'm kind of getting away with the non-standard of care approach, which I just mentioned. So that patient, she had her initial cancer 20 years ago. Now she has a local recurrence, but it's inoperable. And it's strongly ERPR positive. She had been on tamoxifen previously. And so the question for us was, you know, she can't have surgery. Do I really want to give her chemotherapy? Should she have radiation? So initially we talked about radiating her. And then I presented her a tumor board. And when we all kind of started talking to each other, we realized that radiating her and then subjecting her to surgery might be not the best approach. And since she was strongly ERPR positive, we decided to give her endocrine therapy with a CDK4/6 inhibitor. We're going to watch her, you know, every month, every 3 months, we're going to repeat the imaging. And then hopefully in 6 months or so, she'll be a surgical candidate and we can take her to surgery.
So now you got me interested in this case. So did she delay coming in? Is that why it was locally advanced, or was it aggressive, or what did it look like?
It actually did not look as bad. It was a chest wall recurrence that's encasing some of the vessels. So that's really more of why it was inoperable. It wasn't some, you know, mass, exophytic mass that you could see. I think that's what delayed her coming in.
So she had a recurrence 20 years later, and the recurrence was inoperable, and it went into what vessels?
So it was on the pec, and so I'm told that it was the subclavian vessels that were kind of deeming her inoperable.
Wow. I have to get the follow-up on what happens to her with treatment.
I'm curious as well. This is really my first case of treating a local recurrent disease with CDK4/6 inhibitor, so I'm interested as well.
Wow, yeah. And also, I mean, this is critical, this woman's quality of life. I mean, it sounds like not a good situation. So let's get into the more common scenarios. I asked you to pull a few people from your practice. And of course, I want to try to get into the clinical relevance of the big TAILOR-X presentation that just happened at ASCO, really an important presentation. And to get to that, I asked you to pull a couple cases where genomic assays were used in your patients. And I thought we could start out with maybe the big issue, let's say prior to ASCO or prior to some of the recent data coming out, which is patients with node-positive disease. So you wrote up this case here, 68-year-old woman, 2.1 centimeter tumor, 1 of 3 positive axillary nodes after a lumpectomy for ER-positive HER2-negative disease. And I guess the issue there is with one positive, these are sentinel nodes?
Sentinel nodes.
So then the issue is, what about genomic assays in a patient like that? Can you talk about your view of genomic assays in general and the node positive situation and what happened with this lady too?
So when you look at the data with genomic assays, again, we have MammaPrint, we have Oncotype, we have several other assays. The reason I look at Oncotype only is because that's where we have the good predictive data. The other assays have exceptional prognostic data and even more solid than Oncotype does. But when you look at predictive data, that's where I think Oncotype tends to kind of have more solid data. So you look at the node positive patient population, and the kind of the more established trial is the 8814 Kathy Albane's trial, where you're looking at patients that were node positive. Oncotype was done retrospectively. Patients were given either CAF and tamoxifen, or CAF with tamoxifen combined. And the initial trial showed that giving tamoxifen concurrently with chemotherapy is probably not a good thing, but CAF followed by tamoxifen is a good option. Now, on the trial, when they looked at Oncotype, what they found was very similar findings to the adjuvant lymph node negative trials, where patients had a benefit from chemotherapy if they had a high recurrence score and did not have a benefit if they had a low recurrence score. And they didn't seem to get a benefit from the intermediate recurrence score, even though numerically, I'm always concerned because the numerical difference between the chemo versus no chemo was pretty striking in my mind. And so that recurrence score of 18 to 31, I'd be very careful in the node positive patient population as to how to treat them. But if you have a lower recurrence score based on that data set, it doesn't seem that chemotherapy is going to benefit these patients. Having said that, I think it's important to recognize that these patients are going to have a higher recurrence risk than if they were node negative. So prognosis is worse, but chemotherapy prediction ends up being the same. And that's where I kind of differentiate. So I'm not a proponent of doing Oncotype on every single node positive patient. But I think in postmenopausal women where the trial was based on, I think there we can consider doing it, especially in women that are willing to not get chemotherapy given the limitation of data, because this is not a prospective trial. Now, we have the prospective trial, our expander, it's completed accrual years ago. So I'm hoping that soon we will have the results from that trial.
And of course, the big issue here, as you just mentioned, is really the patient and what the patient's view is. So this lady, 68 years old, so she's certainly not in the very elderly population. What were her thoughts about chemotherapy? And did you talk to her about, you know, even before you sent it, or did you send it and then talk to her?
I always talk to them. I don't want to order Oncotype if I don't discuss it with them. Eric Weiner, years ago, I want to say back in 2005, when all these assays were new, came up with these very nice, clear guidelines as to who we should be doing the assay on. And one of them was, if the patient is biased or if we are biased, we shouldn't be doing the assay. So if I already know what I want to do, then the assay is not going to help me. And if the patient already knows what they want to do, the assay is not going to help them either. So in this patient, and what I usually also do is I discuss the fact that the standard of care for her would be to receive chemotherapy. I think that the chemotherapy benefit would be minimal, maybe moderate at best, and that I think that based on some data, which have limitations because it's not a clear prospective trial, that we can order Oncotype as long as we're willing to look at the limitations of the data that we have. And as long as we think that that will help us make decisions. And in this case, you know, like most 68-year-olds, you kind of usually have to convince them to get chemotherapy. And so she was very happy to know that we were going to look at Oncotype and decide in that sense whether to give her chemotherapy or not. And with the results, that definitely helped make that decision.
The result of 18, though, is kind of interesting to discuss. How did you discuss it with her?
So what I told her was, based on the TAILORx data on the node negative patients that were postmenopausal, the result of 18 did not seem to give us a chemotherapy benefit. I discussed some of the node positive data, such as the SWOG trial, such as data sets from Sears, which is a large data set, that again pointed toward the direction that she would not get a benefit from chemotherapy. And so I think based on all of that data, she was comfortable not receiving chemotherapy.
And of course, you know, it's the sort of, I guess, biology versus maybe anatomy kind of thought. And it's interesting that you drew the analogy from the node negative to apply to her. And also, if you think about it, these data that we're going to talk about right now, looking at clinical higher risk in node negative, it kind of falls into that same biologic concept.
It really does. And we've had data with genomic assays such as Oncotype previously on the clinical risk versus the genomic risk. And what that data shows is, again, the clinical risk gives us prognostic data, but it doesn't give us predictive data. And with TAILORx, the same thing was shown, that the prognosis can be tweaked by using the clinical risk data, but prediction ends up being the same. And so when I look at all that data, I try to shield myself from that clinical risk and focus on the genomic risk and then focus on the chemotherapy toxicities. Because again, if you have a patient who you're giving a 2 to 3% benefit from chemotherapy, but based on their comorbidities, you think that the risks are higher, It's really not worth giving chemotherapy regardless of the benefit in the breast cancer recurrence. So those are the things that I kind of think about when looking at clinical risk versus genomic risk.
You know, it's interesting when you began, you were talking about the fact that you use the recurrence score more than the others because of the predictive data. And I was mentioning that our primary target here is the general medical oncologist. And I think you're seeing that throughout oncology. I don't know, I was flashing on CLL for some reason, you know, where there's like a million of these prognostic factors, but yet really there's only three that predict treatment, you know, del17p, p53, and IGVH. And those are the only three. And those are the ones right now that are being used in making clinical decisions. So it's interesting. I think really, I guess breast cancer really, I think, started this whole targeted therapy thing, if you really think about it.
I think so, too. Another is another school of thought that thinks that prognosis and prediction is similar. I don't agree with that. I think prognosis and prediction is different. And you can, again, look at Oncotype in the colorectal cancer arena, where they have good prognostic data, but prediction did not pan out. Again, showing that, in my mind at least, that I want to differentiate on what I want to achieve here. Do I want to achieve prognosis or do I want to achieve prediction? And based on that, I decide on what assay to use.
You know, I guess if you think about it in terms of prediction, I guess the first predictor we ever had in oncology was ER. Mm-hmm. I mean, it is a predictor. The only time I've heard an argument about prognosis that kind of was a little persuading was if through some kind of genomic assay, you can show that the risk for recurrence is like less than 5% or less than 3%. So it doesn't really show a predictive thing, but, you know, like, well, you can't make it any better or risk the treatment is the same. What do you think about that? I've heard that applied sometimes with genomic assays.
And I think you're right. And when you look at the MINDAC data set, that's exactly the point, right? That the prognosis is so good that how much better can we get?
You've got another case here that looks like it'd be very interesting. 48-year-old woman with a 3.1 centimeter tumor, node negative, ER-positive HER2 negative, gets a lumpectomy. You didn't say whether she's pre- or postmenopausal.
Premenopausal.
Premenopausal, okay. So that's even more interesting. And so she gets a recurrence score, and it's 19. So first of all, let's talk about what was presented at ASCO and then track it back into this case.
Sure. So again, at ASCO, we looked at the prognosis versus prediction. We looked at the clinical risk score versus the genomic risk score. How can the clinical risk be incorporated into the genomic risk? And the clinical risk improves prognosis, but it doesn't really change the prediction, even in the younger patient population. So, I mean, the case here, in my mind, what makes it interesting is that you have a 48-year-old with a 3.1 centimeter tumor, and a lot of people will say, oh, geez, I need to give her chemotherapy. And I think that's what helps us with the ASCO presentation, because you kind of have to take away that 3.1 centimeter tumor, because if she had had a mammogram, you don't know when she had a mammogram. Maybe she hadn't had a mammogram in 5 years. So if she had a mammogram 2 years before, that tumor would not have been 3.1 centimeters, but the biology of the tumor would have been the same. So that's why, to me, the size of the tumor doesn't make that big of a difference. And again, we've seen that with all of the data. So then you look at the fact that she's 48 and she's premenopausal, and you look at the presentation from last year, where in this patient population, the group that had a recurrence score of 16 to 20 had, you know, marginal benefit from chemotherapy, mostly in the local recurrence, not as much in the distant recurrence. And that's where I think I struggle, because the discussion ends up being very complicated. And if I show the patient the curves are really very, very close together. And you need a magnifying glass to see the difference. But you'll see a difference of one, maybe two percentage points. And then the patient gets to decide if that's good enough. Now, what Joe Sperano looked at ASCO, and we had kind of discussed this when we were looking at all the slides, was the last slide that he put together that incorporated endocrine therapy with Oncotype and with Taylor-X, which only looks at chemotherapy benefit. And the thought is that these patients that have maybe a higher clinical risk, maybe not a genomic risk that will mean that they should get chemotherapy, but based on that intermediate risk category, maybe we should optimize their endocrine therapy by offering them a variant suppression. So I think that's where the gap in data is, where we don't have clear understanding of whether we should be giving them OFS or not. But, you know, in my mind, that's where the benefit in this woman would be, mostly in ovarian function suppression versus chemotherapy.
And as you say, that debate really started 2018 ASCO. That was the first time I really saw menopausal status really being factored into interpretation of Oncotype. And you kind of saw the same thing this year at ASCO, but now looking at something else, which is the issue of adverse clinical features like tumor size. And did you come away with the same message in general that for the postmenopausal women, pretty straightforward, they're not going to benefit from chemo? Premenopausal woman, not clear. Maybe they're benefiting from chemo. Maybe they're benefiting from chemo-induced ovarian suppression. Did that sort of theme go through this year too, do you think?
I think so. And again, if you're a purist, you're going to look at the data and see all of the gaps in data and say, geez, we can't really conclude that way. And you're probably right. But in oncology, we work with gaps all the time and we have to make the best of it. When you look at TAILOR-X, they looked at menopausal status in the beginning of the trial, but they did not measure estrogen levels. They did not measure, look at menopause after chemotherapy. So all of these are total unknowns. When you look at TEXT and SOFT, they looked at OFS, but again, there's limitations in those trials as well. And the benefit from OFS is not huge, and it does depend on clinical risks, which is why that step analysis is so important. So when you try to marry the two trials that are totally different, they have different patient populations, they look at different endpoints, but at the end of the day, we are faced with these patients every day. I think I at least get back to what the Europeans have been doing for a long time, that what we're doing, what we're achieving with chemotherapy, especially in the younger patients, is making them postmenopausal. And do I really need to subject them to chemotherapy to make them postmenopausal when I can give them a shot or perform an oophorectomy and then make them postmenopausal? So I think in that, at least in that intermediate Oncotype risk score where you're struggling with the decision on what to do, adding OFS is probably beneficial and probably helps you not have to subject the patient to chemotherapy.
So, you know, everybody has different opinions on this. And of course, everybody also individualizes it. It's kind of interesting. This lady is 48 years old, a little bit older premenopausal. She was having regular menstrual periods, completely premenopausal?
She was.
So she has this Oncotype come back as 19. So how did you discuss it with her and what did you do?
So what I discussed with her was the fact that she was in this really marginal category of 16 to 20, where the benefit from chemotherapy, if any, would be small, that I personally would not recommend chemotherapy based on that. But, you know, many people around the country would definitely discuss it with her. If we were to give her chemotherapy, it would be four cycles of probably docetaxel and cyclophosphamide. And then I told her that she would need endocrine therapy, that I thought the best endocrine therapy was going to be an aromatase inhibitor, and that I thought that giving her ovarian suppression would probably give her as much benefit as the chemotherapy would in her case. So given all of that and the fact that she was close to menopause anyway, she agreed to the OFS and endocrine therapy.
OFS or surgery?
She ended up agreeing to OFS. What I usually do, you know, I'm not a surgeon, so I try not to tell patients they need surgery unless they really do. So I usually give them a month or two of OFS to make sure that they actually tolerate it well before we discuss ovarian suppression versus oophorectomy. And many of these patients are perfectly happy coming once a month for their shot. Many of these patients just want to get the oophorectomy and not have to come back for their shots.
I'm just kind of curious. I don't know if you actually got into numbers with this patient, but if she wanted it, or if a patient like this wanted numbers. So she's got a 3.1 centimeter tumor, node negative, and a recurrence score of 19. If she were to say, what's the chance that the cancer is going to come back if I take, you know, ovarian suppression as well as an aromatase inhibitor? Incidentally, how long would you continue that therapy?
So the therapy I'd continue for 5 years, at least with the ovarian suppression. The question would be then, do we want to give extended endocrine therapy? And that's another big dilemma and question for us. The benefit from chemotherapy, I would probably say, would be in the 1.5 percentage points category, which, you know, most women do not want to be subjected to chemotherapy based on that benefit. The benefit of ovarian suppression, that's a question. And you know, when you look at the text and soft, they did the step analysis. So what I usually do, and I don't remember if I actually did it in this case, but I look at the step analysis and I'm able to calculate what sort of benefits she would get from ovarian suppression plus an AI versus tamoxifen. And then I can have a little bit of a more discussion with them depending on how much data they want. A lot of patients, you know, don't want a lot of data. A lot of patients want to be told what to do or want to be given kind of a direction. But some patients really are data oriented. And in those patients, I sit down with the software and I calculate exactly what the benefit from ovarian suppression would be for her.
So, yeah, what I was wondering about is, because I was kind of flashing on a fantasy of a couple years from now, waking up, checking your phone and saying, oh, CDK is positive in adjuvant setting. So I was curious about the control arm and how much better, you know, we have to try to make it. This woman's, you know, a little bit bigger than a typical node negative patient, 3.1 centimeter. But what would you say if she were to ask you, maybe she did ask you, even in spite of all your therapy, your endocrine therapy you're talking about, what do you think my long-term risk for recurrence is? What do you think you would say for her?
I would again look at oncotype and the score of 19. I would take into account, because now it's prognostic data, so you want to take into account the tumor size. So with a score of 19, the risk of recurrence is somewhere between 10 to 15%. And because the size of her tumor is a little bit bigger, it probably would be closer to that 14, 15%. But that really would be it. Again, with tamoxifen, that's data with tamoxifen. I don't think it would be much higher than that. So if you give her ovarian suppression and AI, you're decreasing that by a few percentage points. So you're getting closer to that 10% long-term risk of recurrence.
So it'll be interesting, you know, I don't even know whether a patient like this would fit into some of these adjuvant trials, but, you know, if we did move towards a situation of adjuvant CDK and you think that she's got a residual risk of 10%, and if you could cut it in half, that'd be pretty substantial for a therapy that really doesn't have any life-threatening toxicities.
It would. If I recall, at least one of the adjuvant trials that we participated on, they either wanted positive lymph node patients or they wanted patients that had a high oncotype score. So I don't think this sort of patient would be incorporated in many of these trials, probably for a good reason, because a lot of them you consider their risk lower. And the risk is lower, that means it probably will take a while for their tumor to recur, which also means that these trials are never going to be completed. But also the benefit would be smaller than somebody who, let's say, has a 30% risk of recurrence on endocrine therapy. And then if you decrease it by half, which is what we've seen in the metastatic setting, then you're getting to 15%, which is a huge improvement.
Of course, you know, we're being optimistic by hoping it's going to have that kind of risk reduction. But I do think it is going to be interesting for patients like this, though, because they maybe couldn't have gotten on the trial, and yet if you do see a significant risk reduction, it might be tempting to do. So anyhow, it looks like it's something interesting to look forward to other than checkpoint inhibitors in the future. Let's talk a little bit about metastatic disease, and you got a couple of cases here. How about this 43-year-old lady, originally 4 centimeter primary. She had a metastatic workup and found to have a liver met, which on biopsy was positive, ER positive, HER2 negative, and bone mets. So she presented with what appeared to be localized disease, but actually was found to have occult mets.
So this is, again, this is a premenopausal patient. And what I wanted to highlight was, again, another ASCO presentation when we look at giving a CDK4/6 inhibitor, in this case, ribociclib, in combination with endocrine therapy in premenopausal women and improving survival. This was pretty interesting data. This was the first data highlighting an improvement in survival with any CDK4/6 inhibitor. There's going to be other trials that are going to be presented soon, hopefully showing the same improvement in overall survival. But to me, there's a couple points to make. One, when we look at patients with liver metastases, oncologists are very fast to think about chemotherapy. And I think the benefit of having these CDK4/6 inhibitors is that we don't have to think that way anymore. These drugs work very fast. So within 2 months, you see already a separation in the curves between the endocrine-only arm and the endocrine plus CDK4/6 inhibitor arm. And so if they work fast enough, and they seem to work as fast as chemotherapy, if not faster, there's no reason why we should be subjecting these women to chemotherapy. And then the second, obviously, talking point is the fact that we can give a CDK4/6 inhibitor and get a benefit instead of just endocrine therapy, and the benefit is pretty substantial. Now, there's another presentation at ASCO looking at CDK4/6 inhibitors or capecitabine. And this was a Korean trial, and again in premenopausal women. And it showed, maybe surprisingly to some, not to me, that the CDK4/6 inhibitor outperformed chemotherapy. And these were patients that could have received chemotherapy previously. So these were not just your first line metastatic breast cancer patients, but there was an improvement in progression-free survival. The response rate was relatively similar, numerically a little bit higher, if I recall correctly, with the CDK4/6 inhibitor. But again, you're comparing it to chemotherapy and you're getting better outcomes with the CDK4/6 inhibitor. So to us in breast cancer, that's something we haven't seen before.
Yeah, it's great that you brought up that point. I don't know if you saw a program we put out with Sarah Tulaney we worked on, and we did a survey of oncologists in the community, and we had a think tank with six breast cancer investigators. And one of the most striking things was exactly what you're talking about, a patient with liver mets. And we saw a fair amount, actually the most common strategy in the community was chemo first and then hormone maintenance. And all six of the investigators said, no, endocrine plus CDK. So it was right there in the data. Still today, I mean, that's something we were talking about 25 years ago, I think.
Mm-hmm. I agree. I think whenever we see visceral metastases, we get scared. And I understand that with just endocrine therapy, because even though in the long run, it'll work better, in the short run, it won't work as fast. But these drugs work very fast. Every single trial with CDK4/6 inhibitors has shown a separation of the curves within 2 months, within 8 weeks of doing scans. So to me, there's no reason why we should be afraid and we should be giving chemotherapy to these patients. I've switched my practice completely to giving a CDK4/6 inhibitor.
And actually, this case brings up another thing we saw in this survey, which was I figured everybody was going to use CDK in every metastatic situation in the community, and it's not quite 100% by any means. And actually, the situation where we saw the least, but I mean, it was still 3/4 of people were using it, but a quarter weren't, were exactly the case of this woman, people who present with metastatic disease. I don't know, for some reason, there's a segment of oncologists who won't use the CDK. I mean, again, the minority, but in that situation, any rationale for saving it? I don't know what the strategy might be.
I don't think there's a reason to save the CDK4/6 inhibitor for later. Now, having said that, when you look at the trial presented at ASCO, the number of patients that were not on the CDK4/6 arm that received CDK4/6 inhibitor after progression was very small. So in some way, there's still a question as to whether if we sequence these drugs, we're getting the same benefit. So for example, giving an aromatase inhibitor first line and then giving a CDK4/6 inhibitor second line, are we really compromising our survival or not? And that question is still unanswered. But you know, to me, these drugs are not really that toxic. They, besides some neutropenia, maybe some diarrhea, depending on which one we use, the toxicity profile is pretty straightforward. I think giving our best drug as first line makes perfect sense. The progression-free survival in all these trials is upwards of 2 years. So that's something that, again, we haven't seen in breast cancer before. So to me, I try to give it early on instead of saving it for later lines of therapy.
So you mentioned the ribo data that was presented. What do we know right now about all three of the CDK inhibitors in premenopausal women?
Well, the largest trial was the ribo trial, and there's some subsets in the palbo and I think the abemaciclib as well that were premenopausal, but it was not a large subset in any of these other trials. I think for us, it's a lesson that even though we think we know, unless we do a trial, we don't know. One of the signals that came out of that trial was the fact that we should not be giving tamoxifen with ribociclib. And we had never used tamoxifen with CDK4/6 inhibitors before because of all of the patients being postmenopausal. And if you use tamoxifen with ribo, you're increasing the QT prolongation, which obviously may be harmful. If we hadn't done that trial, we wouldn't have known. So not only do we now have a survival benefit, which we didn't have before, but now we also know we should not be using tamoxifen with ribociclib. And I personally would probably avoid it with some of the other CDK4/6 inhibitors as well, because they do seem to prolong the QT as well.
So, yeah, you know, kind of, I think a lot of people have had the concept of premenopausal woman, you make them postmenopausal, and then you treat them as a postmenopausal patient. But it is true that the data, at least in terms of CDK inhibitors, seems to be more in terms of ribo. What about in the postmenopausal woman? Can you talk about sort of how you go about selecting amongst the three? And first, from your point of view, even in the premenopausal patient at this point, is any way to, it kind of reminds me a little bit of the checkpoint inhibitors, is there any way to differentiate efficacy at this point amongst the three other than Abema, maybe in terms of the monotherapy angle, which maybe is not exclusive, or CNS? Any way to differentiate efficacy amongst the three?
We never like doing cross-trial comparisons, so we always do them. So that's my first kind of statement in the beginning before I start looking at these different trials. And when you look at all of the CDK4/6 inhibitor trials, the hazard ratio is very similar. It's close to 0.5. It can be 0.48, 0.52, 0.53 or something, but it's always close to this 0.5. And so it looks like all three efficacy-wise are very similar. Now, the premenopausal data, we have more robust data with MONALEESA 7 and RIBO. So there you can make a case and say, you know, I really should be using it in that patient population. And other people will say, well, the other drugs have some data as well. And that is a very valid point too. The toxicity profile is something that sometimes helps me decide. I had a patient who had just had acute cholecystitis. And they wanted to take it to surgery, but they didn't. And so this patient came to see me. She needed to be on a CDK4/6 inhibitor. And in that case, what I was thinking was, if something happens and she gets some other attack and they need to take her to surgery, I'd really not be crazy about her going to surgery with an ANC of 0.8. So in that case, using abemaciclib might be a better option, because of the less toxicity in the Y count. But again, you're compromising with the diarrhea because it'll have more incidence, a higher incidence of diarrhea. Now, the other two, the ribociclib and the palbociclib, are very similar as far as toxicity profile. With ribo, you need to do an EKG and you need to look at the LFTs. But to me, it's really more a precautionary measure more than anything else, because there is a little bit of QT prolongation with the other drugs. And you also want to not expose patients to other drugs that increase the QT as well. So those are small differences. And it reminds me of the early 2000s when we had three aromatase inhibitors. And all three had very similar toxicity and very similar efficacy profiles. And we were arguing as to which one to use.
I know it was flashed on the ATAC trial. I think it was like 2001 or something, you know, anastrozole versus tamoxifen, and biggest trial in the history of oncology, 7,000 people. Everybody was all wild and excited because there was a 20% relative improvement. You look back now, it kind of doesn't seem as exciting as the stuff that's going on right now.
Exactly. And none of these AI trials are showing much survival benefit either in the metastatic setting. They never did.
But it was just huge, huge news. What about monotherapy with a CDK inhibitor? What data did we have on all three of them? And do you ever use it? And what situation?
So the data that we have is with abemaciclib, and it's in later line. So that kind of affects our patients, not as much anymore, because now we start with a CDK4/6 inhibitor. But if we have somebody who's been on endocrine therapy, maybe has been on some chemotherapy and has gone down all the endocrine therapy lines, then giving abemaciclib first line seems to be a viable option. It is approved by the FDA. I honestly have not used it, and mostly because most of the patients that I had not been on all the endocrine therapy drugs. And so I was able to put them on fulvestrant and a CDK4/6 inhibitor, or an AI and a CDK4/6 inhibitor. But it's definitely a valid option for some patients.
Any reason to think about using it after CDK inhibitor, after everything else?
No data. There's trials ongoing. And so that's the other unanswered question in metastatic disease. Can we sequence CDK4/6 inhibitors, or can we give the same one post-progression like we do with trastuzumab, for example? I've never done this because we don't have any data. So to me, it's an unanswered question.
So the other thing I was mentioning that you kind of hear about, I'm not sure exactly how relevant it is the issue of CNS penetration. Is there a difference in the three? And I don't know how often you run into a situation of a patient who has CNS disease where this might be a factor.
There's, to me, not a lot of data, mostly because in ER-positive disease, we don't think of CNS disease as a primary issue. The more these patients live, the more we are going to see it. And I've seen it in my patients, but usually I've seen it in patients that have been on several lines of therapy. And some of them may actually develop leptomeningeal disease. My thought is that it may be because of the bone disease that is there that eventually will invade the meninges, but who knows? I mean, there's some data with abemaciclib, and you can think of using that agent preferentially there, but I don't know that I'm convinced that it's only abemaciclib doing that. I guess we'll get some more data in the future and we'll be able to see better.
Any comments in terms of your clinical experience dealing with some of the toxicities that you've talked about? You mentioned GI problems with abemaciclib. When do they start? What do you see? Do you do anything preemptively?
I don't do anything prophylactically. I talk to the patients and I ask them. They usually start soon after we start the CDK4/6 inhibitor. And I've usually looked at loperamide as my go-to medication. And in most cases, it's relatively well controlled with that. Now, when you look at the other two, you're dealing with ANC decreases. And the question is, how stringent do you want to be? When we first were exposed to these drugs, we were following the guidelines. And if any patient had an ANC less than 1,000, we were stopping and rechecking. And now I think most of us have moved away from that approach because what I got to was starting and stopping and starting and stopping and starting and stopping. Because the guidelines didn't really say you should dose reduce. They said you can dose reduce. So patients seem to be doing fine. The risk of neutropenic fever is pretty low with these drugs. The risk of infection is a little bit higher. So maybe in the more vulnerable patient population, a little older patient, something to keep in mind. But in the majority of patients, I haven't seen much as far as infections. And if I do, it's usually grade 1 or 2. So nothing that will require hospitalization. So I tend to be way more lenient with my ANC checking than I used to be.
What do you do in terms of dose reduction, though?
I will dose reduce if a patient has fever, if they see them having an infection. And the good news is that the data combined from all three of them is showing that dose reduction does not compromise efficacy. So I'm very comfortable dose reducing these patients without thinking that I'm compromising how the drug is going to work.
That's interesting. You mentioned a patient going to surgery. If you know in advance that a patient needs minor surgery, major surgery, or tooth extraction, for example, do you take that into account in terms of the scheduling related to the CDK, particularly obviously with palbo and ribo?
I do. I think that's where you might run into more issues if you think of a tooth extraction in somebody who has a neutrophil count of 0.7 or 0.8, that probably, might get you in trouble. So I usually will think of using abemaciclib or delay the CDK4/6 inhibitor if I have the luxury to do that.
So I want to ask you about this 54-year-old lady, just specifically about one issue, because we've been thinking a lot about CDK inhibitors in terms of where the patient is in the natural history. Your first patient was at first diagnosis. A lot of patients get diagnosed with mets during adjuvant endocrine therapy. And then the other space is people who've had adjuvant endocrine therapy stopped and then get recurrence later, which is what happened here with this 54-year-old lady. And it's interesting that she actually got adjuvant tamoxifen for 5 years. So she was premenopausal in her mid-40s. And then she was off therapy at 3 years and came in with metastatic disease. What was the situation when she presented there with the bone mets? She had symptoms from the bone mets?
She did. She came in with back pain, which is how we diagnosed her with a metastatic disease.
And she had bone-only mets?
She had bone-only disease.
And did anything need to be radiated, or you thought you could use systemic therapy?
So that's the other tricky point, whether you can radiate someone and keep them on a CDK4/6 inhibitor at the same time. And there's some case reports that suggest that you might increase toxicity in some ongoing trials. So personally, I think most people, we don't do both together. If you want to radiate someone, you kind of wait on the CDK4/6 inhibitor, you radiate them, and then you start the CDK4/6 inhibitor. In this case, her pain was not severe enough and her MRI was not bad enough that we needed to do anything at that point. So we ended up putting her on endocrine therapy plus the CDK4/6 inhibitor.
Yeah, and actually the thing that I was most interested in is which endocrine therapy. So you gave her anastrozole. Of course, she'd only had tamoxifen. But another very common situation is a patient who's had 5 years of an AI. What do you do when they relapse after they've been off 3 years?
There, I think it's justified to give them fulvestrant. If it's been 3 years, I think re-exposing them to anastrozole makes sense. The one thing that people may want to be considering is, should I do a genomic profile and see if the patient has an ESR1 mutation? And if she does, Should I then give her fulvestrant? The way I look at it is when you look at the CDK4/6 trials and look at ESR1 mutations, whether a patient had it or not, they still received the same benefit with the AI and the CDK4/6 inhibitor. So I don't usually do the genomic assays for that reason. So I think if it's been 3 years, re-exposing her to the AI makes sense. And then obviously adding the CDK4/6 inhibitor, and then second line, you want to think of fulvestrant plus another targeted agent.
Actually, you tied into another issue that we've been giving some thought to, which is the issue of multiplex genomic testing in women with metastatic breast cancer. And of course, you could view breast cancer easily as at least three different subsets. But in terms of that question, so for a patient with ER-positive HER2-negative metastatic disease who's going to go on first-line therapy, endocrine therapy, and CDK, do you do some type of genome? Do you do NGS? Do you do liquid assays?
I do sometimes. It almost never helps me. There was a nice debate 2 years ago, we had it at SABCS, about whether these genomic assays help or not. And, you know, in breast cancer, they rarely help us at the moment, especially in this ER-positive patient population. Sometimes you kind of want to do it because you're hoping it'll help you. But if you think about it, how is it going to help? If a patient has an ESR1 mutation, you probably want to avoid single agent AI, but you almost never give single agent AI anyway. And if you combine the A with a CDK4/6 inhibitor, you're fine. If you combine it with an mTOR inhibitor, you're probably okay. Then you can find a PIK3CA mutation, which obviously is huge because now we have alpelisib that was approved and should be considered standard of care for this patient population. But we have a specific companion diagnostic for that. And it's still unclear to me whether the large multiplex panels capture all the different exons that need to be captured for the PIK3CA status. Then you have, you know, P53. If that's positive, then you know you're in trouble because these tumors are just going to be resistant to everything. But again, you don't have any treatment options. You know, if the HER2 comes back positive, then you have to kind of wonder what HER2 are you looking for? Is it just the immunohistochemistry that some of these assays are running? Is it mutations? And then you may want to be exposing them to a tyrosine kinase inhibitor, but again, that's not standard of care. So a lot of these assays will not give us great results or actionable results.
Anyhow, and this lady, she got anastrozole and palbo, and it's now 3 years later. How's she doing?
She's been doing okay. She has not progressed on the CDK4/6 inhibitor yet. Now, when she progresses, I think the option, if she is PIK3CA mutated, is going to be to put her on fulvestrant plus alpelisib. If she's not, then an mTOR inhibitor is probably the next option for her in combination with endocrine therapy. I think fulvestrant would probably be my endocrine therapy.
So I am curious what your thoughts are about alpelisib. I'm curious about your statement there that if she were PIK3 positive, you think that would be the treatment of choice. So maybe you can kind of go through the data and explain why you believe that. Because actually, I think everolimus is a pretty good drug too.
I think so as well. And you can definitely sequence, I mean, you will be sequencing these drugs. Now, when you look at the alpelisib data that was published at SOLAR-1 trial, which was presented at ESMO, represented at San Antonio with some extra information, and then recently published, the drug approved in May, showing that in patients that are PIK3CA mutated only, the combination of fulvestrant plus alpelisib was superior to just fulvestrant. Now, very few patients, less than 20%, were given a CDK4/6 inhibitor in that trial. And I can't remember, I think mTOR inhibition, again, was a very small number, subset of patients. So that's where we don't really know, is alpelisib going to work post-CDK4/6? Is CDK4/6 going to work post-alpelisib? What do we do with mTOR? Those are, again, the gaps that we have to deal with. But I think based on the data, that's a nice targeted approach in that 40% of patient population in the metastatic ER-positive setting that are going to have mutations in PIK3CA, that I would definitely consider it probably as my second-line therapy. The limitation is going to be toxicity. And the major toxicity with alpelisib is hyperglycemia. And, you know, initially when you think about it, you say, oh my God, hyperglycemia, I can deal with it. We actually initially, when we participated in the trial, there weren't very strict criteria. We had a patient hospitalized with hyperglycemia. So hyperglycemia is not something that we want to take lightly. It happens very quickly. So you want to prophylax your patients that have a high blood sugar. And if they don't, you want to watch them very closely because they can develop it.
What about other tolerability issues? Any side effects?
The rest of the side effects are pretty manageable. You may have a little bit of diarrhea. You may have a little bit of rash. The rash is dose dependent, the diarrhea as well. So that's, again, it's going to be a learning curve of how to use the medication and how to deal with the toxicities like it is with every medication. If you see a rash, you can dose reduce and the patients should not experience it again. Same thing with the diarrhea. The hyperglycemia, definitely something to keep an eye out for.
It's still kind of hard, you know, initially we were hearing kind of negative things about tolerability with this class of agent. Is this one better tolerated than some of the original ones?
It is. So the original studies were done with the pan PI3 kinase inhibitors, and those tended to have more toxicities, including some psychological issues with major depression. But the targeted one, so this is a PI3 kinase alpha inhibitor, those are much more easier to tolerate. So definitely easier. I go back to when we initially started using everolimus. We all thought it was almost as bad as chemotherapy. It caused mouth sores, it caused a rash, diarrhea, pneumonitis. And now we use it like it's nothing. Why? Because we got to use it enough times that we've figured out how to deal with these toxicities. We figured that we want to give a mouthwash and that pretty much gets rid of the mouth sores and so forth. I think there's going to be a learning curve with that, with alpelisib as well.
So if you have a patient who, say, develops metastatic disease on an adjuvant AI, they get fulvestrant CDK first line for Mets, and then they have disease progression and they're PIK3CA positive, I'm guessing it sounds like you're going to go with alpelisib?
I will. The question is going to be the endocrine backbone since alpelisib was approved with fulvestrant. But I think with all of these agents, there's good data and there's now ongoing trials with alpelisib looking at alpelisib plus AIs that you can partner them with pretty much whatever endocrine therapy you want to efficacy-wise and you're going to be okay. So I would give her second line alpelisib plus endocrine therapy, third line everolimus plus endocrine therapy.
And so I'm assuming or guessing that if the patient were PIK3 negative, you would use everolimus and endocrine therapy?
I would. I mean, those are active drugs. And I think when you sequence these drugs in breast cancer, you've yet to prove on any survival benefit. So you're definitely justified in my mind to give everolimus second line and to give alpelisib third line or the other way around. I guess the reason I'm thinking of alpelisib is I like the fact that there's a mutation and I am attacking that mutation and that's why I'm getting the benefit versus everolimus where we haven't really shown a patient subset that everolimus works better in. And that's probably what's driving my decision. But you're absolutely correct that you probably can sequence these drugs perfectly fine.
So let's finish out with your last patient. This sounds really fascinating. 36-year-old postmenopausal woman because she had a BSO who's BRCA2 germline positive. And did she know prior to being diagnosed with breast cancer about the BRCA?
She found out at the time of diagnosis.
Wow. She had a family history?
She had a limited family history. It's interesting how 50% of the patients that are diagnosed with BRCA mutations do not meet criteria for testing.
Right, although sometimes I wonder what the criteria for testing is going to evolve into with the use of PARP inhibitors, but I guess that's more metastatic disease. Anyhow, so she has ER-positive, HER2-negative metastatic disease to the liver and spine. Now, this was at presentation or she had a recurrence?
That was at presentation.
Again, okay. And so she gets started out on an AI and palbo, but then has progression in 6 months. That's pretty unusual.
It looked like she had endocrine-resistant disease, and that was my concern as well. I mean, you're expecting these drugs to have a PFS of around 2 years, if not more, and six-month PFS is very, very low, very, very short.
But now, she got the BSO after she found out she had breast cancer?
Exactly.
That's interesting. So, well, she's getting an AI and palbo. So she was PIK3 positive. Is it just positive or negative, or is there like a number?
It's positive if whether they're mutated or not. Again, the trick is to make sure that you're checking their hotspot exons on the PIK3CA, but she was positive, so she had a PIK3CA mutation.
That's interesting. So it's kind of like maybe the EGFR situation in non-small cell lung cancer, different types of mutations of PIK3?
There are different types of mutations. I don't know that we have enough data to show that one is better than the other to have, so we've kind of looped them all together. And so if anybody has one of those mutations that compromise the function of PI3 kinase, then they're called mutation positive and they're eligible for alpelisib.
So she actually got started on it 9 months ago. So she was one of the early people. I guess it wasn't even approved then. This was on a trial, I guess.
This was on a clinical trial, exactly.
And what endocrine therapy was it combined with?
It was combined with fulvestrant.
Fulvestrant, right. That makes sense. And how did she do?
You know, she actually did not do very well. She progressed relatively quickly on alpelisib, and that's when I switched her to a PARP inhibitor, and she's actually doing really well with a PARP inhibitor, and this was the first medication that her tumor responded to. She had some stable disease with palbo, but she never had tumor regression, and this was the first scan that she received that had a decrease in her liver lesions.
I was going to ask you about PARP. She got olaparib?
She ended up getting talazoparib.
Talazoparib, interesting. You started her on it?
I did.
That's interesting. Just out of curiosity, why did you choose talazoparib?
The data looks very, very similar. So the reason I did was it's once a day. It's a little bit easier to give. I think that's why I picked it. But, I mean, those are equivalent medications.
Do you think the tolerability profile is also equivalent, incidentally?
A little different, a little more hair loss, I think, with the talazoparib. And I want to say the red cell count's a little bit worse, but very, very similar in many other respects. I think you're trading one thing with the other. I mean, she's tolerated the medication wonderfully up to now. And like I said, she actually had a response. But I mean, I think based on the data from both trials with PARP inhibitors in breast cancer, they're equivalent drugs.
I have heard about the hair loss. Did she have any hair loss?
She did not.
Interesting. So it looks like she was on alpelisib, though, for 9 months. I mean, that's not too bad, is it?
It's not too bad. She had stable disease.
But she didn't respond.
She did not have a response. She had stable disease. And when you look at the data from SOLAR-1, I think the median PFS was a little bit longer than that. But she responded better to the PI3 kinase inhibitor than CDK4/6 inhibitor.
Did she have hyperglycemia?
She had a little bit of hyperglycemia. She was lucky enough to be a very fit 36-year-old. And so we did not run into any major issues with her blood sugar.
So you didn't have to treat her?
Did not have to treat her.
Yeah, you know, the general oncologists know about copanlisib, which is used in lymphoma, but that's IV. And I think those patients get hyperglycemia like during the infusion, and then it goes right away. But here you're taking a pill.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I know they're not the same drug, but I guess it's sort of the same class. So, you know, when I saw this case and I saw the first three words there, BRCA2 positive, I immediately was thinking, where is PARP going to fit into this story? If you had to do it again, or if you found a situation like this again, or even just this basic situation, what about hormone therapy plus PARP?
I don't know. It's hard to know whether you're going to get a benefit. There's really no data that I'm aware of combining the two. You know, you could think of starting with a PARP inhibitor and then giving endocrine therapy later on. And again, there's no data on the sequencing. Patients on both PARP trials, if they were ER positive, they could have received endocrine therapy previously. I think I'd probably do it all over again because you have a patient who's ER positive. And so you're thinking of toxicity. She's 36. She has two young kids that she's taking to school every day. And so making her sick is not really what I wanted to do, especially since she was, you know, relatively asymptomatic from her breast cancer. So I was perfectly happy trying to maximize her endocrine therapy as much as possible before I subjected her to chemotherapy. And thankfully now we have PARP inhibitors as well.
I wasn't suggesting using that strategy, incidentally, because I think it might be also tricky to figure out toxicity and then you have to stop both of them. So yeah, there's no data. Of course, that's another issue. But it is interesting, though, when we present to breast cancer researchers where they put PARP into BRCA germline patients, for ER-positive HER2-negative, they almost all give hormone CDK first. but they do give PARP before chemo. But just out of curiosity, even though we're focused on ER positive or HER2 negative, what about triple negative BRCA germline? And of course, there you have the issue also of checkpoint inhibitor chemo.
So I think there, I would definitely look at PD-L1. I think that now we have a valid option. I probably would still give a PARP inhibitor first because it's less toxic than chemotherapy. And then upon progression, I would consider giving the atezolizumab plus nab-paclitaxel chemotherapy if PD-L1 positive. And if PD-L1 negative, chemotherapy, which probably second line would end up being a platinum in a BRCA positive patient.
I think you're reflecting what most investigators are doing, but I wasn't not quite sure because of the atezolizumab making it a little bit more complicated. PD-L1, definitely a factor. Just to round it out of curiosity, HER2 positive BRCA germline, where, if at all, do PARP inhibitors fit in?
Rare, but definitely happening. The trials did not include HER2 positive patients. So that's going to be yet another gap that we have. I personally would not treat them any differently as far as whether I would give them a PARP inhibitor or not. But now we have other treatments such as anti-HER2 therapy, which is pretty effective in this patient population. So how to sequence these? I don't know. That's a good question. I haven't had a metastatic patient that I've had that dilemma on. It makes it even worse if that patient is also ER positive and now you have all three options to consider. I'd probably consider anti-HER2 therapy up there, especially since in many of these patients, you can keep them on dual anti-HER2 therapy without chemotherapy for a long time. And then again, toxicity is pretty good. And do you really want to stop the anti-HER2 therapy to give the PARP inhibitor? Who knows? Again, no data because the patients on both trials had to be HER2 negative.
Yeah, it's interesting. It's not that much different than when we were talking about hormone therapy and PARP, but there you have CDK. That's making it even more complicated. But that's life in oncology, isn't it?
Gaps in knowledge, that's what we deal with. That's why I guess we're not replaced by machines yet.
Subsequent to this interview, on September 13, 2019, the FDA issued a warning that palbociclib, ribociclib, and abemaciclib may cause rare but severe inflammation of the lungs, and concluded that the overall benefit of CDK4/6 inhibitors is still greater than the risks when used as prescribed. This concludes our program. Special thanks to our faculty, and thank you for listening. This is Dr. Neil Love for Breast Cancer Update.